This is The Guardian.
This week, we're revisiting some of our favourite episodes from 2021. And today, we return to an interview with one of the world's most famous models and the author of a recent collection of essays called My Body. This is Emily Ratajkowski, on what that career has been worth to her and what it's cost her.
Emily!
Stay like that from up this way!
Over the shoulder, Emily, over the shoulder!
Look this way! All the way back, all the way back!
I called myself a mannequin because it's a French word for model, and it helped me when I was first starting to model. Mannequin felt like a way of almost explaining that it was an industry and that my body was being used.
Emily Ratajkowski has a face and a physique that have been used to sell thousands of products, from Fenty underwear to Versace haute couture. In millions of pictures posted across social media, in the tabloids, on the front covers of fashion magazines, her doe-like, deep brown eyes have gazed out at us. But it's her body and the way she uses it that has fascinated and even outraged some people since she became world famous in 2013 for dancing almost naked in the Blurred Lines video. Hadn't really expected to gain notoriety for that performance. She'd studied fine art at university and thought that one day she'd make money from selling her work or being in films. But modelling was suddenly far more lucrative.
I really was almost like a clothes hanger. I would shoot the front, the back, the side, change, put on the different clothes. So you really feel like a mannequin. And it was my way of saying, you think of model as this glamorous term, but this is just like a way I'm making money, and I have the right figure for this very specific niche thing that helps sell clothes.
Now she's written a book of essays about her experiences in the fashion industry. You might have heard about it already because one of the lines from it has leaked in the press. Her allegation that Robin Thicke assaulted her on the set of the Blurred Lines video. But the book's about much more than that. It's about how her body has been used as a tool and how she uses it to make money, how it carries the weight of her teenage traumas and how it's carried her son. From The Guardian, I'm Hannah Moore. Today in focus, Emily Ratajkowski's body and what she wants to make of it. A note before we start that in this episode, we discuss sexual assault and rape. Emily, in a previous episode of Today in Focus, we looked at the kinds of power dynamics and abuse that are pretty common in the modelling industry. And when I was producing that episode, I spoke to lots of models, former models and agents. And one of the things that really struck me was how much these young models' self-image was controlled by how other people saw them.
I was in magazines being dressed up like a prostitute, being told to stick my head into car windows. As a 14-year-old girl, I had no idea what that actually meant. And these were for fashion magazines, and you kind of see yourself through these pictures, but you don't see yourself as a person.
One of the inspirations for that was an essay that you wrote called Buying Myself Back. And I believe you listened to the episode. Did the stories you heard there sound familiar to you?
Yeah, I actually remember where I was when I listened to the episode because it felt so powerful to hear other young women talk about their experiences on set where they were put in positions that they didn't feel like they could say no to.
Now, that essay you wrote is included in a book called My Body, which is all about how you think about your own body and the power you have over it and how that shifted over the course of your life. So I wanted to ask you, Do you remember when you first became aware of the power, maybe the sexual power that your body could have?
Yeah, I write about it in the introduction of the book. I hit puberty quite early and I developed a woman's body before I was a woman. I felt the response to the world change and shift, and I didn't understand it because I didn't even know what sex was. But I also could feel the positive attention and the way that men looked at me and how that could feel good and powerful being noticed. And then I also felt deeply embarrassed and ashamed. I had developed before most other girls at my school, and you know, there were very strict dress codes in place, and I knew that it was shameful and bad, and that I was a bad girl if I let my stomach show or if my bra strap fell out. So kind of from the get, it felt really complicated, where, you know, felt both good and bad.
And then you started modeling when you were 14. What made you want to do it?
I wanted to do it because it seemed to me that there was nothing more important or seductive than the power a quote-unquote hot girl could have. And I wanted to be hot girl. I think my parents felt like it was a great opportunity and a way for me to potentially secure my future. Being a working model, you know, it means that you're making a decent living, definitely more than what, you know, my friends in high school were making, working service level jobs. So it felt really exciting.
And how did it feel, you know, in those first few castings, when you'd have meetings with your agent, to be scrutinized?
I remember going to my first agency's office and looking at all the comp cards on the wall and just thinking that those women have made it, and feeling super nervous that, you know, an agent was going to tell me that something was wrong with me, but also feeling almost like manically excited because it seemed so special.
You write that when you lost weight, you lost 10 pounds over quite a rapid period, that you started to get more work. You say, as the number on my scale went down, the number on my checks had been going up. How did that make you feel?
Well, I felt very embarrassed that I had ever weighed anything more. You know, I really wanted to live in New York when I dropped out of college, but I was working a lot in LA, and I kind of said to my agent, like, well, that's my aspiration. And she said to me, you know, I just don't think you should try to be something that you aren't. And I didn't really understand what she meant until I lost the weight. And she said, actually, now you should go to New York. And I remember thinking, oh my God, I can never gain that weight back.
At that point in your career, you'd been told by casting agents that you wouldn't be getting work really as a high fashion model. It'd be more commercial work. And then you got offered this job with Pharrell Williams, T.I. and Robin Thicke. And that would become the shoot that would make you super famous, the Blurred Lines video. Can you tell me how you felt when the email offering you that job came through?
At that point, I'd been really rejected by, you know, the Sports Illustrated, the Victoria's Secret, and I had really hardened in a way. And this is right after the economy had crashed. So the thought was sort of like, well, if I do this while I can, because, you know, I'm not going to be young forever, I'll be able to make enough money to then decide what I actually want to do. So it felt like I was just hustling.
And you talk about some very good experiences on the set of that, having this positive female team around you, female director. But in your essay on this, you talk about being groped on the set by Robin Thicke.
Yes, that's correct.
You write, I felt the coolness and foreignness of a stranger's hands cupping my bare breasts from behind. I instinctively moved away, looking back at Robin Thicke. He smiled a goofy grin and stumbled backward, his eyes concealed behind his sunglasses. It's clear from reading that that you didn't feel a sense of agency or have the power to stop him. Is that an experience you still think about a lot today?
I didn't let myself think about that moment on this 9-hour day shoot. I just sort of washed over it because it didn't feel congruent to what I wanted to believe, which is that I was that girl from the video, and look what it's brought me. I'm now famous and people know my name. And so I didn't talk about that part of the experience because I felt like it was revealing and humiliating. And it really wasn't until kind of the post-Me Too era, me becoming a little older, getting close with new people, including my husband, and, you know, wanting to really to know them and for them to know me, that I started to reflect on overall my experiences as a model. And in that moment, it came flooding in, this one part of the shoot that I had never acknowledged before to myself or to anyone. Even now, talking about it, I don't like the weird position that it puts me in. I mean, I think that online we have this discourse of like, oh, women, tell your truths, and that's so brave, whatever. But, you know, I see firsthand the conversations that happen behind the closed doors, and the other feeling, which is like, now she's complaining, but look at what, you know, it brought her, and how could she do that to that man? Why are you letting the world know about this, like, moment he was drunk and did something stupid? I still feel those voices even as we're talking about it, and, you know, have a little bit of like panic and feeling like, oh God, I can't believe I'm talking about this. And humiliation.
I mean, Robin Thicke has said in interviews since that he'd never make a video like that again. And he's admitted that he was having substance abuse problems at the time. How does it feel to you when you watch that video back, if you ever do?
I watched it back to write the essay. I mean, it's mixed. I think it's still a fun video in some ways. Like, I think that there's a reason that it went viral, and it wasn't because it was naked girls in a video. There's a lot of videos like that. I think there was sort of this silliness and fun and rawness to it that felt cool and weird and kind of like, oh, there is something else going on. You know, that being said, it did feel like we were props on set. And, you know, the thing I have to say about Robin Thicke, and really all men, is that I'm sure that he's a wonderful person in many, many ways. And that's not at all to like apologize or whatever, but to say that our culture has this sort of idea of like, if we get rid of the bad men, then things will change. But I just don't believe in bad or good men. I believe that we have a culture and a system that allows for men to sometimes unknowingly, sometimes maliciously take advantage of women and their position and of power. And I think we have to have conversations about those experiences specifically, but hopefully those conversations, instead of landing, you know, towards like, oh, this person is a bad person, that they'll help evolve the overall culture. That's my hope.
I want to ask you about one of the toughest parts of the book, the story about Owen. Do you feel okay to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, thank you for asking. I do.
So you write in the book about a boyfriend you had when you were 15 who developed this unhealthy obsession with you after you broke up and then raped you when you were drunk. And one thing that comes through in that essay is the way it made you question and doubt yourself. You ask, why did my 15-year-old self not scream at the top of her lungs? Who had taught me not to scream? What did you mean by that?
I wrote about this relationship and this experience because I had shame around it, not because I even was ready to put the words rape or stalking. I saw a recent review where somebody said, you know, an essay where she's like is stalked. And I was like, oh my God, I've never used that word before, but that's totally what it was. So obviously I'm still kind of processing these experiences. So I think that when I was writing about the experience of waking up and having somebody I knew and had been intimate with before using my body while I was not awake, it was so hard to write about that and relive it. And there was a moment where it was like, it's a real question. Why hadn't I freaked out? Why did I feel like I couldn't say no? Or why did I feel like I shouldn't have jumped up and pushed him off me or whatever? because that's the part that made it so hard to talk about, was because I had so much shame about the way I didn't protect myself.
You blamed yourself to some extent.
Totally. Yes.
It's so, so upsetting to hear. And there's no way that you could have possibly negotiated within that situation how you responded to it, right? Your body goes into fight, flight, or it freezes, and you do what you feel like you have to do to protect yourself.
Yeah. And, you know, especially in that circumstance, I can feel empathy towards myself because I was so young, which was why it was such an important essay for me to write, because it helped me. You know, I meet a 15-year-old girl now and they feel like a child. But of course, you know, I didn't think I was a child when I was 15. So it helped me to have empathy for myself in that situation.
Coming up, Emily responds to criticism about the pictures she shares of herself on social media. Do you ever wish that you looked different to the way that you do, and that you didn't look like a model, and that you didn't have a look that has been perceived as sexually attractive?
No, not once. My experiences have led me to these truths about life and about the world we live in that feel fundamentally important. So I'm grateful that I was able to succeed in this world enough that anyone wants to listen to me talk about them. If the way I look plays into that, which I think it does, that's a gift, undeniably.
You obviously get a lot of love and praise from people on Instagram, but some of the stuff is pretty spiteful. And you must have to be thick-skinned to deal with seeing that stuff.
Yeah, I think that I am and I am not. I mean, I think, you know, the internet has become this sort of bizarre mirror where you both hear the things that you never want to hear about yourself that in times in the past you never would have. And then you also, you know, get all this praise and you get attention, which even bad attention is still attention sometimes, you know? So it's like a weird double-edged sword. As I've gotten older, I've just realized I can't let those things bother me, because a lot of the times it's not even based in reality or based in something that I was trying to communicate or express.
So one of the really interesting things about the book is the way that you let us into that thought process that you're having. Some of the contradictions of, you know, the idea that you've benefited hugely from this system of fame, of publicity, and at points as well you felt totally trapped by it. What would you say to somebody who said, well, why don't you just opt out of it?
Yeah, I mean, I'm really used to hearing this argument when it comes to my politics, because I'm critical of capitalism, and, you know, anyone who's critical of capitalism, you hear from people, well, why don't you then just stop trying to make money in the system? And I think that it's very much true for women. This is the world that we live in, and how one survives and tries to succeed operates within specific confines. And I do believe that you can work and try to succeed within a system while also being critical of it. I think OnlyFans is a perfect example of it. It's, of course, young girls want to gain power from how they look. It's the way of taking control over something that's going to happen one way or another. I think that every woman is on a spectrum of compromise, whether she decides to completely avoid sexualizing herself or decides to exploit the way that our world sexualizes women and uses her own body in that way. I think it's the wrong politics to try to criticize that woman. Instead, we should be looking at the system that allows for this sort of abuse and also praise simultaneously.
In March this year, you gave birth to your son, Sly, And you detailed on social media the transformation that you went through physically. But how has the actual feeling, the experience of being pregnant and giving birth, changed the way that you look at and feel in your body now?
So one of the big themes of the book is control. And what I realize is that even in writing the book, it's sort of like an attempt at control, controlling the narrative. But the experience that pregnancy taught me is that the only way to really have control is by also letting go of control, because then you can relax into reality and then you're okay with sort of what's happening. Like, that's part of healing and existing in a happy way. Every day you're growing and things are changing and you're feeling these different hormones and there's nothing you can do. And that was an incredible lesson to me, giving life. I mean, it's a really humbling experience.
And now you're in this new phase of your life. You're a writer, indisputably, because you've got this beautiful book that I'm holding in my hands.
Thank you.
I thought it was interesting that in the acknowledgements, you give thanks to Stephanie Danler, who's an author. She read some early drafts of this and told you, yes, you are a writer. Why was it so important to you to hear that?
It became clear after reading all the essays that I've internalized a lot of the feelings, that I'm not much more than my body. And that's what, you know, my value is. And as somebody who has thoughts and ideas and always wanted that people respected my thoughts and ideas and who I am, it was really hard for me. And I totally internalized it. And especially with writing, you know, you always hear writers talk about, oh, I kept a diary from a young age and I've just always been a writer. I've always known I was a writer. And I do have a little bit of the imposter syndrome, coupled with also feeling like wanting to prove to people that I'm more than just a body.
It's very thought-provoking and it's obviously very, very brave in parts as well.
Oh, that means so much. Thought-provoking is pretty much all I wanted from it.
Emily, thank you so much for speaking with me.
Oh, thanks so much, Hannah. I really appreciate it.
That was Emily Ratajkowski, whose collection of essays, My Body, is out now. If you want to hear the episode of Today in Focus that we mentioned at the start, which is about abuse in the fashion world, you can find that by searching for The Ugly Side of the Modelling Industry. We contacted Robin Thicke's management for comment on Emily's allegation against him, but didn't get a response. If you've been affected by any of the issues we've discussed in this podcast, you can contact Samaritans by calling 116 123 or emailing Joe, that's J-O, at samaritans.org. If you're in the UK, the charity Rape Crisis is available at rapecrisis.org.uk and their number is 0808 802 9999. If you're in the US, RAIN offers support. Their number is 800-656-4673. That's it for today. I produced this episode alongside Eva Krisiak and Elizabeth Kassin. Sound design was by Axel Kukutier. The executive producers were Archie Bland and Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow with another of our favourite episodes from the year.
This is The Guardian.